I bring you greetings from Malawi, Africa. And I wasn't aware before I went just how many people are there whose mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and other relatives are here in this community. I knew there were a lot, but they send their greeting. We had probably 75 or 80 people in the total, including children, at the retreat. And I came back with a briefcase full of notes and films and letters and things for those who are relatives of those people. Some of the finest people I've ever known, I met there during those 3 or 4 days or 4 or 5 days with them. I could tell you a whole story about it and probably need to report at length, but I'll not do that today. Well, we're coming down to the wire, aren't we? In fact, from the looks of this congregation, it was graduation last Sunday. It looks a bit thin today. I don't know where everybody is. But we're getting on down toward the wire, and the pressures and the tensions that accompany these final days are real. I want to ask you a question. How are your relationships with people coming? How are they coming along? Your relationship with your roommate, with your teachers, with the administration, or vice versa, how are those of you in the role of administrators or teachers, how's your relationship coming along with each other and with your students? Those of us in the community, how is your relationship with your wife developing, or your relationship with your husband? We all are in times of stress or strain, and this is not just characteristic of this time of the year. We're more and more entering into a period of our history in America when we're under stress and strain. And we're going to be called upon to either react to people in the way that Jesus reacted to them, or else react to them in the way that the world reacts. One will make an impression that will be for good. One will be an impression that will be for bad. I was impressed recently in reading in the book of Matthew the encounter between Jesus and Simon Peter. Simon came up it's in the 18th chapter, and Simon asked the Lord, "Lord, how many times should if my brother sins against me, should I forgive him? 7 times? I think the law, or at least the traditions of the Jews, had stipulated that it had to be 4 times, that you should forgive your brother 4 times. And probably then Simon was being very generous when he suggested 7 times. That's almost double. But then Jesus opens up a whole new horizon of human relationship when he tells Simon, not 7 times, but 70 times 7. And so this whole new broadened and lengthened and deepened relationship that Jesus says life is to be built around. And I don't doubt but what it surprised Simon, because essentially what Jesus was saying was that it's to be an infinite amount of times of forgiveness, that forgiveness doesn't really know any boundaries. Now that was perhaps unheard of in that day, but it was the basis upon which Jesus built his relationships with people. And when I found that, then it opened up a whole new dimension to me of understanding, because I realized that Jesus would not have been telling Simon Peter to forgive people 70 times 7 had he and his father not been involved in that same practice. And the day I realized that what Jesus was telling Simon was actually the philosophy of life that he himself used as he approached people, and consequently that his father used when he approached people, I began to see another side of God that I never had seen. Oh, I knew generally that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish. I knew that generally. And I knew, as Simon Peter said about 30 years later, that God is not willing that any should perish. I knew that. But concretely, I saw some things about God that I never had seen before. Because whenever we look at Jesus, we see specifically and concretely and visibly those attributes of God that to the finite mind are nebulous and are hard to grasp. And things that are just concepts in general become actual specific practices. And things that are just precepts, or not precepts, but that are principles or concepts, become genuine relationships. Something that you can put your foot on and you can see and feel and touch and understand. Jesus said, "He who has seen me has seen my Father." And I've said this hundreds of times to where probably you're saying, "Yeah, we already understand that. When you see Jesus, you see God." But I want to ask you today, in regard to human relationships, how did God treat people? How did he treat people? "For God so loved the world," well, that's good. Man, I'm so thankful for it. But that's not really what touches us, really. It's too broad. It's like people saying, I love the church, but it's those people in it I can't stand. And it's possible for God, or it's possible for us to love the world and then just be as ornery and cantankerous as we can be toward people. How are you with your neighbor? And you young people, as you prepare to go home, how are you going to be with your mom and your daddy? How are you going to treat them? How are you going to live with them? You're going to be with them about 3 months. That's a long time to be in the presence of people that much older than you. You know what old folk is? It's terrible. 3 months with the same folks, how are you going to treat them? I think if we can get a glimpse of how God treated people, we'll be able then to see that that's the way we're supposed to treat people. How did Jesus treat people? Because when we see that, we'll know how God related to people. I think basically we're going to have to conclude that Jesus essentially came to be a liberator of the oppressed. Turn to Luke, the 4th chapter, and let me read his own description of his mission. This was his description of his ministry. You know, when he went after his baptism, he went back home. John records it in John 1. He walked about 65 miles from where John was baptizing and walked back to his hometown of Nazareth. And then, as his custom was, he went to church. On Saturday, went to the synagogue, as they did. And when he came in, no doubt they were pleased to see him, and the person in charge of the service went up to Jesus and said, "Will you read for us today?" Jesus said he would, so the time came, and he took the role of Isaiah, and he stood up to read. And this is what he read: "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captive, the recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed." He closed the book and sat down, and the eyes of all in the synagogue were upon him. And he said to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." Now, there are four words there. We're not going to emphasize them, but I just want you to see them. He talks about the poor, the captives, the blind, and the oppressed. And he says, "My ministry is to these people." I find many times that our ministry is to everyone except those. When Jesus came into this world, he stepped into the arena of life and set himself squarely in between the oppressed common people and the oppressors, who in that day and in almost every day are the entrenched religious people of the day, who out of their traditional backgrounds and all find themselves actually to be the oppressors of people and the bringers of bad news. Jesus came to bring good news. And so it is that as he dealt with people in this role of a reliever of the afflicted, and as a rescuer of the oppressed, Jesus had a certain way of dealing with people. He spoke kindly and gently to those who were the oppressed. He spoke forcefully, fairly, but forcefully, with those people who were doing the oppressing. And it seems that he He didn't pit them one against the other. They were pitted one against the other anyway. But Jesus just simply let it be known that he had come to relieve the oppressed. His cleansing of the temple illustrates this. In John 2, and also in the latter part of the gospel, in Matthew the 21st chapter, his cleansing of the temple illustrated how he would not tolerate anyone oppressing the poor any longer. He said, "My Father's house should be called a house of prayer, and you've made it a den of thieves." Not only his cleansing of the temple does it illustrate it, but his battle with the traditions of the day that actually contradicted the Word of God, that in effect were oppressing the people. These things elaborate his stand to liberate those people who were oppressed. The incident about the Korban, where those people were actually taking the money that they should have been giving to their mothers and their fathers and their grandmothers and grandfathers, and relieving the oppression and relieving the poverty of those people. The Jews had worked it out, and their tradition was such that they could say, well, that with which you would have been blessed by me ordinarily has been given to God. It's Korban. It's sacred. And he said, you don't then allow yourselves to help the aged and help your relatives that need help. And he said, you're a hypocrite. And so he put himself again on the side of the oppressed. And everywhere you turn, you find him elaborating on this, the mission that he came to accomplish. Jesus' mission was people. That's why he could say that the Sabbath was made for man. Man wasn't made for the Sabbath. And the principle is simply that institutions were made for men, were made for people. People weren't made as chattel for institutions. What God has given us, he did for the good of people. He didn't create people in order to satisfy some dictatorial concepts that he had regarding his own authority. He has people in mind, and everything that he's done for people, both the yeses and the noes that he's told us, both the prohibitions and the rights to do and the freedoms. All of these are for people. And then his great invitation when he said, "Come to me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, my burden is light." That was the advertisement that Jesus hung out. If you look at him as one who had an office or as one who had a business to take care of and a minister to perform, he hung out his shingle. And on the shingle it simply said, in essence, "Come to me, all of you who are oppressed and who are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. My yoke is easy and my burden is light." So Jesus really came as a friend of people. He came to be the liberator of the oppressed. I'm impressed by the fact that he was a friend of publicans and sinners. Now, we're familiar with that story, or with those stories. My goodness, it's more than one story. And yet it's the story from beginning to end. He was a friend of tax collectors and sinners. That was the reputation that spread abroad about him. In Matthew the 11th chapter, Jesus reflected this reputation of his that had been circulated. He said, "They say that I'm a friend of tax collectors and sinners." It not only was being noised about him, but it had come back to his ears, and he was hearing people whisper behind his back, "This man receives sinners and eats with them. This man is a friend of tax collectors and sinners." And it's true. But the thing I want you to see and want myself to see today, the principal essence of what this indicates of his personality and of the philosophy with which he, around which he built his life and around which he built his relationships with people, the philosophy of being friends of tax collectors and sinners is simply this. He was a friend of people who were different from him. That's about all it says. He was a friend to people who were different. They weren't the same kind of folk as he. You see, he was a poor man, and yet he was a friend of tax collectors, people who were rich. He was a very holy man, and yet you find him a friend of people who were sinners. Well, what it says is that he was able to condescend toward people who were not really what he was. Can you do that? You know, there are a lot of people who are different from you. There always will be. You never will be able to whip everybody into shape to where they're going to be just like you and you're going to be like they ought to be. I never will be able to. I never will be able to whip all you into shape so you'll be just exactly like you ought to be, so you'll be just like me, you know. I never will be able to do that. How am I going to act toward you? How are you going to act toward your roommate when she may be just as obnoxious as she now goes on and leaves you in a few weeks? When you first saw her, boy, she was so odd. Well, he was just plain out of it, you know. How do you treat people who are different from you? Well, Jesus was there, and I'm not doing this to be, I want to tell you exactly what was said of him. He was their friend, literally their friend. Now, people know that. They sense when they're different from you. They sense when you're aware of that difference. They know. People aren't blind. And they know that whenever they, if they have some peculiar characteristic about them, they know that. And they know that's the one thing that probably is the most visible thing and the most obvious thing about their personality. Are you able to accept people in spite of what they are? Now that's the dynamic upon which Jesus built his personal ministry and upon which he built personal relationships. He was able to accept people in spite of what they were. Can you accept people whose circumstances and whose actions you cannot condone? Can you accept them anyway? He wasn't in favor of the way the tax collectors stripped the people. Now, he wasn't condoning them. He wasn't condoning the adultery and all the things that went on among the people of sinners. He wasn't condoning that. And yet he had this magnanimous quality about him that just simply reached out and in love just brought people in, whether they were tax collectors or sinners or whatever. It just didn't make any difference. He was able to be a friend to people who were different from him. And oh my, what it does to personal relationships. What it does to people, and how it just serves kind of like a hothouse and creates an atmosphere in which growth can take place, in which development can take place, and in which people then can accept themselves. And because they find, by the way, he loves me. I don't know how, or I don't know why you say he would like me. And then many of us, you see, are thinking, you know, if you really knew me like I know me, you wouldn't like me either. Because we've never really learned to like ourselves. But here came this very unconventional character, walking with grace and ease among everybody, building bridges to those who were different, knocking down barriers that had separated those who were different, just striding across these chasms and bridging gaps and things in personal relationships. And everywhere he was going, people were just looking at him, and there just didn't seem to be much of, that he couldn't do it in the way of bridging chasms and spanning gaps between people. He was a friend of tax collectors and sinners, a friend of people who were different from him. Can you do that? Would you set your mind to doing that this summer? You say, well, it's a bit late to start out the school year and do it. Well, it's not really. You might need to go to someone and just simply say, you know, I've failed you this year. You're different from I. And I've looked down my nose at you and I want you to forgive me. Can you forgive me for that? And that may be all you can do. And then you say, next year I'd love to be your roommate again. And I guarantee you things will be different next year because I'm going to live like Jesus and I'm going to make friends like he made friends. But there's a second thing that I noticed, and I'm impressed by the fact that he was able to serve people that he couldn't save. He was able to serve people that he couldn't save. You know, religiously, we let people know, we advertise sometimes that we're only willing to serve those that we can save. Which communicates to us, from us, we're thinking, well, really, what I'm interested in is your soul. Well, let me tell you, Jesus was interested in people. People are souls, but people are also people. And he was able to serve people that he couldn't save. Judas is the man that comes to my mind first. The night he was to be betrayed, Judas was right in the thick of the betrayal, you know. He'd already made arrangements and everything had been set. And there he was among the 12 on that night in the supper. Jesus could have said, Judas, if you'll excuse us now, those of us who are spiritual have some things to take care of. and then proceeded to wash their feet. He could have said that. But he didn't. Judas was there in the midst of those men, and he knelt down before Judas and served him and washed his feet, even though he couldn't save him. He served those who were his executioners also, whom he had never met, probably. Just a one-time encounter, and that was an antagonistic encounter, one that simply they did him in. And yet he served as their, what you might call their counsel, before the prosecution or before the justice bar of God. While they were killing him, he said, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." What does it say here? Well, it just simply says that he served people, really, he just served them whether he could save them or not. So really, though he came to seek and save, it says, he came to serve and not be served. But are you willing to give your life to people, whether they ever become followers of Jesus or not? Are you, as you see people in long-term relationships that finally, like Judas, prove to be unworthy and they prove to be unresponsive to the love of God, can you keep on serving them and wash their feet like Jesus did Judas? Can you tell the atheist, the man who says, I may never become a Christian, can you tell him, "Well, I know that, but I want you to know one thing, you've got a friend in me as long as you live. And if you ever need me, day or night, for anything at all, whatsoever, I want you to know that you just have to call, and I'll be here." I guarantee you that kind of love doesn't exist among the world today. If Christians don't provide it, it won't live. And if the church doesn't provide it, the church won't live. Because it's that kind of love, and it's those kinds of relationships upon which the kingdom of God is built. Or those momentary passing relationships where you say, I don't know his name, and I never will see him again, so I'll just disregard him and treat him in an uncourteous manner or discourteous manner. You know, we do that. If we think we're away from home and nobody knows, I don't know him, he doesn't know me, and he'll never see me again, it's easy just to kind of bump into the fellow and go ahead and stand in line first. I saw a beautiful thing. You know, standing in line, I have been on a plane for the last 10 days and in a train or plane station for so many hours recently. About all I've seen has been relationships between people. And I saw a lady do something that was very kind. She just stepped back. She never had seen this person before. She stepped back and said, "You go ahead before me." And I thought, now that's it. There it is. She was willing to serve somebody that she never had seen, may never see again. And yet she was willing to serve her in that very genteel way. But not only did he serve people that he couldn't save, Jesus saved some folks that really weren't worth all that much saving when you look at it from the human point of view. Who comes to your mind when you think of that? He saved some folks that, when it gets right down to it, their value to his cause really wasn't all that much. Who's the man that stands out like a sore thumb? Who? Well, no, he knew what Peter was going to be. I'm talking about, who was it? The thief on the cross. You know, time-wise, and as far as what you could see, as far as humans could see, you'd say, well, Lord, why waste time on him? It's not really worth it, is it, to go to the trouble of saving somebody like that? He's only got about 15 minutes to live. Well, Jesus was willing to do that. He was willing to save people who, on the surface, looking at it from the human point of view, weren't really worth all that much saving. Now, the principle is this in our personal relationships. Are you willing to serve and save people and to be with them, even though, obviously or seemingly, there's no return in it for you? Are your friendships and your relationships ulterior in your motives? Sometimes people get the impression that, here they come again, these religious people. Here they come again. They want me just for what they can get out of me. People never did get that impression around Jesus, because he gave his love with no strings attached. And he allowed himself to be spent for people when, in the final analysis, you don't really think that there's much there to invest in as far as returns are concerned. That's why Jesus could say, when you have a feast, don't invite your neighbor who can invite you back, or don't invite your brother or your relatives, or don't invite your friends who can invite you back. Invite the lame and the blind and the halt. He said, these people can't repay you. Jesus was always making poor investments. That's what it just boils down to. He was always making poor investments. In people who were unworthy, in people who had really no means by which to make a return. And I thought, recently, I thought, you know, the unlikeliness of that man's ministry, it staggers me. In fact, these thoughts came to me really in that context, the unlikeliness of Jesus' ministry. He was a friend of tax collectors and sinners. He served people that he couldn't save. He saved folks that, as far as humanly speaking, it didn't look like there was any return coming. And I thought, how unlikely could his ministry be? And yet, look what's happened. And it may be that the converse of that is true in our own lives and in our own growth or lack of growth, because we seem to separate ourselves from tax collectors and sinners, the church. We seem to shy away from that kind of people who are the down and outs, and we seem to shy away from that. We seem to serve only the people that we think we can save, and we seem to save only the ones that we think are going to be the middle income. And I don't mean that as just a sweeping indictment, but you examine your heart and see if that may not be the reason why our growth rate has been such that it's practically nil. We have been so conscious of making proper investments that we have forgotten all about how Jesus intends life to be lived. Well, then finally, it says he was kind even to the ungrateful and the thankless. Kind to even the ungrateful. I want you to flip over to Luke 6. You're already in Luke 4. Look at Luke 6, that very offensive chapter. He was kind even to the ungrateful and selfish. Beginning in verse 32, he says, if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, now there's your investment, you see. If you're lending just to those that you're hoping to get something back from, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies and do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return. Lord, that's not good business. I know it. But it's good Christianity. I used to be so offended by this chapter, I really wished that it weren't in the Bible. Same thing is true with Luke 14. I've often thought, wish it weren't here. Just cuts right across my grain. Lend to those expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. For he is kind to the ungrateful and the selfish. He's kind to the unworthy, is what it's saying. So much of our actions toward people are extended because of the fact that we felt like that we've examined them. We feel like that they're worthy, and then we give to them. That wasn't Jesus' approach. His love was without strings. Now, have you developed to the point that you can be kind even to the thankless and the ungrateful? It takes some growth to do that. I'll tell you what else it takes. It takes dying to yourself, to be able to lay your life down for people who are thankless and ungrateful. But Jesus says this is the dynamic of human relationships that makes the kingdom of God a reality and makes it an oasis in a barren desert. I think of all the things that Jesus said, that it's a maxim, really, very simple, about 6 or 7 words, but it sums up the entire philosophy of Jesus regarding human relationships. And it's the statement where he said, freely you have received, freely give. Freely you've received, freely give. not close-fisted. He said, you've been given so freely, now you give freely. The follow-up of that statement by Jesus to Peter, when he said, oh, Peter, not seven times, but 70 times seven, the very next thing he says was a parable. He said, therefore, the kingdom of God is like a man who had two debtors. And one owed him, what, 10,000 talents. No, excuse me, that's not the, no, I beg your pardon. This king had a servant, Matthew 18. The king had a servant, he owed him 10,000 talents, and he couldn't pay, and he asked for mercy. And he just, then the king just gave him 10,000 talents, $15 million or so. Just let him off. Said, I just, it's all right, I forgive you. That man went out then and looked for one of those men who owed him about $25 and wouldn't do the same thing to him. And Jesus gave that as an illustration of human relationships. You see, that's what broke down between this man and the man owed him the $25. It was human relationships. He had forgotten what God had done for him. But if we'll remember what God has done and the way he treats people, the way he came to relieve the oppressed, the way that he stood in between the oppressor and the oppressed, the way he came as a friend of tax collectors and sinners, liking and loving and being a friend to people who were different from him, the way he was able to serve people that he couldn't save, not checking out all the debits and all the credits and all the assets and the liabilities of it, not that, and able to save people that maybe that he couldn't... that weren't really worth all that much to him. Again, checking out the debits and the seeing that the balance was just right. And then able then to be kind and gentle to people who were really ungrateful and unthankful. If we'll do that, then life will begin to take on itself a glow, and you'll begin then, as I saw a little poster in the airport this week that showed the two little people with big eyes. What are those? You know, the artwork of little children with the big eyes. And they were there facing each other. And it said, he who brings sunshine into the lives of others cannot himself avoid it. And he who brings generosity and grace and liberality into the lives of other people cannot himself avoid the blessings that come from it. How are you getting along in your personal relationships? Follow Jesus and watch how he treated people. And then imitate him, and I guarantee you, life's going to have a thing about it that's just going to shock you. May God bless us. Today, you may have been such in your life that you find that surely he couldn't forgive me. I've offended him so many times. Man, I have offended God. Wait a minute now, remember. This God that we serve, whom Jesus represents, is the God that said, not seven times, don't just forgive him seven times. 70 times seven. And it may be that you've reached that point that you think, well, he couldn't forgive me again, but he can, and he will. And he urges you to come and respond in whatever way you may need right now while we stand and sing.